points this way, which prevents the charges from moving anymore. And this electric field means that there will be a potential gradient. I have a strong electric field over a small region, and that means that there is a potential gradient. So if I move from phase one to phase two, the electrostatic potential will be doing something like this. And so I have this voltage difference between the two phases. And so the total chemical potential, which is what really matters if I'm interested in equilibrium, the total chemical potential of phase one will be the original internal chemical potential for that phase plus the electrostatic contribution, which is the electrostatic potential, and the same happens for phase two. And so this voltage difference will grow until these two quantities become equal. And then it stops growing, and at that point, I have somewhat reduced the Gibbs-free energy of the system from with respect to the original state where I had no charge layer. And I have reached an equilibrium state in which I really haven't changed any of the macroscopic properties of the two phases. I have just changed the boundary layer, and I have established a complete equilibrium. So my claim is that this might very well happen. So we could perfectly well have coexistence of two homogeneous phases at one pressure, and that means an abrupt transition from one homogeneous phase to another homogeneous phase. And we actually have to figure out how much this mixed phase costs in order to decide whether it exists or not. And so the mixed phase may exist or it may not.
But you have the same piece of microphysics occurring in those little blobs, right?
Yes, that is true. And these little blobs are usually claimed to be of sizes which are of the order of maybe even a little smaller than the screening black hole. And it's unless the total surface energy associated with this boundary is negative. Unless that's negative, it will be more energetically more favorable to have just as little surface as possible, or to have some structure on scales smaller than the screening leg, where you have to look at it into more detail whether that trigger happens or not.
Yes, it's the same thing as a thermocouple.
I'm not sure. Actually,
they put two different metals together.
Yeah,
there is exactly this thing. I
think. Okay. Yeah. Certainly, if you put two metals together, you will establish this voltage difference.
But you put it in some heat. Depending on the temperature, this voltage will depend on the temperature. So you can produce the battery essentially by doing this.
Yeah.
Is how they make some of the heat sensors.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Are there any observational effects that appear to depend very much on whether there's a sharp boundary or some region of droplets?
Well, one thing people have been worrying about here is what happens at the phase at the boundary between the crust and the core of the neutron star. How will dissipate energy there if you have some oscillation modes or something? And that may depend strongly on this. I think nobody has really looked into what happens if you have this mixed phase, but there it would certainly play a role. And other than that, it may also strongly affect transport properties. It's probably very different to diffuse heat or a charge through a phase like this than through the pure lead phases. And there's some effect on the global equation of state and the masses and so on.
No, yeah, but if it's a real thin layer, it probably doesn't do
much
more.
The claim is that the mixed phase may actually occur over a very macroscopic scale, something like a scale height or something.
In a way, that's what happens in the crust. If you try to make this Yeah, neutrons, protons, and electrons. And the protons and neutrons like to clump and leave electrons outside.
Yeah.
And you must take into account all those electrostatic forces.
Sure.
When you see what the lowest energy state is. And you don't satisfy the usual condition in between the nuclei, just pure electrons.
You don't satisfy which usual condition?
If you assume that the equality of Gibbs potential of the free energy was true everywhere, you start to get into a bit of trouble. Go into two different phases at least at the same time. You could think of that as a mixed phase.
Well, I think you could still describe it in terms of constant chemical potentials, but you would have to put in the strong interactions and everything. So I think there is no contradiction, but it may be difficult to look at it that way.
But it's inhomogeneous when you start to look at it on a scale of 10 to minus 11.
Yeah, but this total chemical potential should actually be uniform everywhere, I think. But you have to put in whatever interactions there are with the other particles around and so on. So I think it's non-trivial, but I think it's still true. Okay, now I will start talking a little bit about the dynamical part of this. And I see that I was right that I wouldn't have enough time to cover everything. But here, state of stratification, the usual thing is that... I have some fluid element in the star. Well, not necessarily in the star, this is any fluid in the presence of gravity. I have gravity quite in that way, and I have this fluid element which I displace from its equilibrium position to a new position with the conditions that this displacement is slow enough so that it keeps pressure equilibrium with the surrounding matter, but not too slow so that it has not, that it doesn't have time to chemically and thermally adjust to the surroundings, so that it actually conserves both its chemical composition and its entropy per variable. But there are variants of this way where you actually allow for equilibration of some things. But here I will talk about this particular case. So that means that if the background fluid is actually an equilibrium, so both the entropy and the chemical composition are functions of pressure, they will vary throughout the background fluid. Since this displaced fluid element did not vary its properties, it will generally have a different density from the surrounding matter. And that means I get a restoring force. And the restoring force per unit displacement, per unit mass, I can write it this way. Here, derivative tells me how much the pressure is varying across the region where I displaced. This is the derivative of the density with respect to the pressure in the background fluid. This is the derivative of the density with respect to the pressure in my perturbed fluid element. And this gives me a restoring force, which is defined in such a way that it is positive if it's stable, in the sense that the restoring force points backward. And the square root of this is the so-called Brunn-Weissmuller frequency. And I can also write this thing in terms of the usual gammas, which we use for stellar models and so on. But this gamma is the so-called adiabatic index, which tells me how much things vary in the perturbed fluid element, and this is how much things vary in the equilibrium, in the background equilibrium fluid. So, well, basically what I need is that this thing in parentheses here has to be positive, because the P by the R is negative. And then I can write this derivative as one first term, which is this derivative I leave with entropy and the chemical composition constant, plus two other terms, one which accounts for the variation of the entropy in the background fluid, and the other one which accounts for the variation of the chemical composition in the background fluid. And so I need the sum of these two terms to be bigger than zero for stability with respect to that dynamical convection. In non-degenerate stars, it's usually this term which dominates, and then I guess the so-called Schwarzschild criterion for stability. But in neutron stars, it's actually this term which dominates, because the neutron star is highly degenerate, and as I discussed, we will have a chemical composition which will generally vary with position because it's in chemical equilibrium everywhere. And so in that case, this term is very small, and this is really the dominant term, so I'm really interested in whether this one is actually bigger than this. So, we can actually write down a little theorem which tells me that an isentropic multi-component fluid, where isentropic means what it really means, which is that the entropy is constant throughout the fluid. Multi-component means that there are several chemical, several species of particles. In an isentropic multi-component fluid, in full chemical equilibrium, in a gravitational field, is always staying stable. So basically what I'm saying is that in the cases where I'm neglecting this first term, so I'm really interested in this one, and the entropy is actually constant for the star, or basically this term I can forget about, then this term will always be bigger than zero if I am in chemical equilibrium. So, so what I need to show is that this derivative of the density with respect to the pressure at a fixed entropy, because I'm telling you this is isentropic, but in chemical equilibrium, is bigger than the derivative of the rho with respect to P at constant entropy and with fixed chemical composition. Now, for this, since we are working with pressures and entropies, what we have to minimize in this case is the enthalpy per baryon, which will be a function of pressure, entropy, and this rise of higher with composition. And so, I'm fixing the entropy, so I am interested in what the enthalpy does as a function of pressure. And I'm saying that the equilibrium state is that which minimizes the enthalpy at fixed pressure and entropy. So I will have some line on the enthalpy pressure plane, which is the blue line here, which will represent the equilibrium state. And I'm saying that this is the minimum enthalpy at given pressure which I can get. So all the states down here, so basically where there are no allowed states in the system down there, all the allowed states are up here. The equilibrium states are on the line and the non-equilibrium states are above the line. And so if I take some fluid element here and I perturb its pressure, for example, by raising it, like that. This fluid element will have it will go out of equilibrium as a movement, either up or down. Up would be this way, down would be this way. And so this line, which this the fluid element follows as a perturbative, will have to go above the equilibrium line on both sides. And that tells me that the enthalpy is a function of pressure in the perturbed fluid element. At this point, has to have the same derivative, but a larger second derivative than the equilibrium enthalpy is a function of pressure. So, writing that here, maybe I leave it up there so I can write it behind me. So what I'm saying is that at this point, the derivative of these two lines is the same. And this derivative is actually the volume per volume, because of the basic thermodynamic relations. And the second derivative in this line, which is this one, will be bigger than the second derivative of this other one. But since the first derivative was the volume per baryon, what I'm saying with this is that the volume per baryon has this relation. The first derivative of the volume per baryon of the pressure satisfied this relation. Now, in a Newtonian fluid, the mass density, which was the thing we were interested originally, is just the mass per baryon divided by the volume per baryon. And so I get, from this relation, I get the opposite relation for the derivatives of rho that you can see, which is what I wanted to show. And in a relativistic fluid, I actually have to replace the mass density by the enthalpy density, rho plus p in the usual notation. And that enthalpy density is the enthalpy per baryon divided by the volume per baryon. And since the enthalpy per baryon has the same derivative with respect to pressure, both in the equilibrium and in the and with the perturbation, I don't care about that. And so rho is basically determined again by what really is good. And this will be applied to the theory. Okay, and this answers a question raised by Chris Thompson in this talk, and basically, and to some extent, answered by himself. But I think this is a more general proof, and which tells me that in general, the stuff in the star in equilibrium has to be stable stuff. And that I should discuss that later of this talk. It would be quite strange if this were not true, because then you could become a constructive perfectly mobile, where you would have stuff rise up at the goal of chemical equilibrium, be out of, would be not stable stratified anymore, and would have to go back, and so we could permanently get energy out of that. But this tells me more locally what's going on, so that we can assure that won't happen. Okay, I guess I'm already over time.
Your penalty gas has been reduced by a factor of 2.
It's 2?
It's like you're halfway.
Yeah, it's sort of halfway. Yeah. Let me see. I could skip over a little bit of the stuff and then talk about the last stuff, which is probably more interesting. Will I do that?
Okay. I'm not wrong. You can take a photo or something. I'm not sure what you're going to skip.
You're going to put the whole thing on the web, right?
Yes, yes.
How much stuff do you want?
Not much. I'm going to make sure you guys.
Just keep going. You can stop in 15 minutes, that's fine.
Okay, yeah, I should have you stop before that. Okay. Yeah, so I went before my time to stop it. I was going to say about the way we stay and so on. Well, now if we think about the same fluid element, which is displaced from its equilibrium position. And basically now we will concentrate on the fact that we are doing a Lagrangian density perturbation with that fluid element. Fluid element is changing its density. So that means that it's at its new position, the concentration of electrons, for example, will be different from the equilibrium concentration. And that means that there will be a discrepancy between the sum of the chemical potentials of protons and electrons with respect to the chemical potential of the neutrons, which I can write approximately as this formula, which holds basically in the free fermion case and assuming that there are relatively few electrons around. And this tells me then that I have some chemical energy which I could release by having reactions which make this stuff back to chemical equilibrium. And this will lead to dissipation, as we see what Bob pointed out in the old days where the neutron stars were just starting to be discovered. And so I will have some net reaction rate, which I will call gamma, not to confuse with the adiabatic gamma, which changes the concentration of electrons and which will be the rate of protons to electrons being converted to neutrons minus the rate at which neutrons are being converted to protons and electrons. And now, if I have small oscillations and relatively fast, meaning fast compared to the rate at which the stuff goes to equilibrium, the process can be described as both viscosity, as a both viscosity terms in terms of motion. That's very sorry from this out several years ago. And from that I get a both viscosity coefficient, which goes as the derivative of this with respect to the departure from chemical equilibrium, at small departures from chemical equilibrium, and I get this 1 over omega squared term, which is basically telling me that in the first place I can do this only for oscillations where I have some well-defined omega, so it's not a term which I can put into my general equation of motion. And that's basically because the dissipation does not depend on the velocity field now, but on what happened some time ago. Because I could have some divergence in the velocity field, which makes the stuff denser, and I wait for a while, and I would still have dissipation going on, although the stuff is not moving anymore. And that's something that in the case of oscillations, this factor is accounted for. And in the general case, well, when you would have to do some more careful treatment of the whole thing. And it's true only for small perturbations in the sense that the chemical energy release rate, which is the number of reactions times the energy released in each of the reactions, can be written in this way, where this U which is in there is the ratio of delta mu, which is equal to the temperature basically. And there I have several nonlinear terms. So this linear description of the whole thing is true while this U is much smaller than U. If I have a perturbation from equilibrium, which is much smaller than Kp, basically. So the general thing would be this. The neutrino emissivity field is also changed when I do this perturbation for chemical equilibrium. The neutrino emissivity will leave the emissivity in equilibrium times this big production factor. And so basically, the non-linear terms here will become important when U is of order unity, and that means that delta rho over rho has to be of order the temperature over temperature value Kelvin. And that's interesting in the sense that here I have non-linear effects which come into play, which might come into play at possibly small density perturbations, because if I reduce the temperature, this can be a relatively small number. And if I compare these two terms, well, this, as I said, is the chemical energy which is being released, and this is the total amount of energy which is emitted in the form of neutrinos. So the difference between these two is what is staying in the star. And depending on how big this U is, either this first transition dominates, so this is actually bigger and the star cools faster due to the chemical imbalance. But if U is big, so I have a big chemical imbalance, then I will actually be heating the stuff because this term is bigger than this one. So as I say here, this leads to enhanced cooling for small, relatively small discrepancies from chemical equilibrium, and to strong heating when delta mu is big. And this I have in this plot. In units of the cooling rate, in the absence of this effect, I'm plotting the total amount of dissipated energy and the net heating, which is the difference between that and the neutrino emission. And you see that this thing here, the first goes down and then goes up, whereas this increases quickly. And in the limit of very large departure from chemical equilibrium, we will actually leave 5/8 of this dissipated energy in the neutron star and emit 3/8 in the form of neutrinos. All this for modified Auer reactions. So this effect can lead either to heating or to cooling, to faster cooling of the neutron star. This I will say only very quickly, which is that if I have a neutron star which is spinning very quickly and it is spinning down, so the centrifugal force is going down, the star will be contracting, so the stuff inside the star will all the time be going out of chemical equilibrium and the reactions will try to keep up with this. And so I will have a departure from chemical equilibrium all the time, which is increased by the contraction, decreased by the reactions, and I have the temperature then increased by the release of chemical energy and decreased by the emission of neutrinos and photons. And so I can actually follow the evolution of these two things. And so here are neutron stars which are spinning down due to magnetic dipole braking. These are hypothetical neutron stars which all start with 1 millisecond periods but which have different magnetic fields. In this first case of a strong magnetic field, not much happens because at the beginning the star slows down quickly, so loses its rotational energy quickly. So while it still has a lot of internal heat, so this effect won't be doing very much. But in the case of a low magnetic field neutron star, the spin down is slow, so the star is cooling down while the departure from chemical equilibrium is increasing. And then at some point, existing parts of the chemical equilibrium is producing enough heat to keep the neutron star at some relatively high temperature. It prevents it from cooling until the star actually spins out.
What's the core temperature?
These are core temperatures, and the delta mu is also expressed in units of Kelvin, basically, to have a comparison between those two things.
Well, in the real world, you have to worry about forming VCS gaps and suppressing.
Yes, and I have actually looked into that. In that case, the effect is probably even stronger than in this case, because since you have the VCS gap, you will reduce the reaction rates until the departure from chemical equilibrium is similar to the gap energy, and only then you will start having a significant amount of reaction, and at that point the temperature will get higher. Yeah, and finally, I have looked a little bit at what this effect may do to our modes. And the interesting thing is that if
I'm almost ready, so
what this means for our mode is that if I have this our mode oscillating at some amplitude, the dissipation due to bond viscosity will actually go up as the amplitude increases, and so that might mean that the R modes saturate at some point where the dissipation is as large as the driving from the gravitational waves. But it's not a very significant effect in the sense that the saturation amplitude, let's look at it at the Keplerian frequency of the star, will be quite large no matter what the temperature is. This wall here is where actually the bulk viscosity is always stronger than the gravitational wave driving, so the modes don't grow. And in this region, at lower temperature, the modes may grow due to gravitational radiation, and they would stop growing once this line is reached if there are no other effects. But this line is quite high, the modes are already very non-linear, so this is probably not a very significant effect. Yeah, and I guess I should definitely stop now. Okay, thanks for your patience.
More questions?
Yes, John.
I was just wondering what you would give as the uncertainty in the location and temperature of that wall.
Well, I think the main uncertainty comes from the fact that we don't know exactly what the mechanism for neutron star cooling is. We usually use these modified Oerker reactions, which is the slowest possible mechanism. So pretty much everything else which we can put into the neutron star, kaon condensate or quarks or a little more electrons or whatever, will make the cooling faster and would move this wall a little bit this way. It probably would.
Why would it change the location and temperature? So if that were time, then I could understand.
It changes the location and temperature because at a given temperature, it increases the reaction rate and it therefore increases the bulk viscosity.
So you're saying that the cooling rate is tied to the bulk viscosity mechanism?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is basically the same process.
Right, but then the wall's not going to move very much because, for one thing, the temperature dependences tend to be very strong. So if you modify bulk viscosity coefficients, and we screwed this up by a factor of 300 the first time around, and then when we fixed it, the difference was almost imperceptible.
Yeah.
Another thing is that the kaon condensates and all the other funny particles that you can think of are going to happen down in the core, and the mode doesn't have much presence down in the core.
That is right.
Yeah. I did the exercise of putting in direct ERCA, which is the other extreme, which is pretty much the fastest possible, and assuming that that was going on in the whole neutron star, which is of course not right. And that moved this line down by a factor of 5 or something like that.
Because it's a factor of 10 to the 10 strong.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Take 8 through of that.
Yeah. So there, even if you take a 6th root or whatever, it is an effect. But
same for a pion condensate. That's also a comparable factor, stronger than a modified Burka. So even though it's only in the core of the star where the amplitude may be down by a factor of few.
Yeah, and most of the dissipation is going on at the radius, which is something like 2/3 or 3/4 or something like that of the total neutron star radius.
70%.
Sorry?
70%.
So it's probably not a very big effect, but we don't know this very precisely. I think it could easily be wrong by a factor of 2 or so, but I don't know whether it would be much more.
This is also for you.
And that's true for this also. This, yeah. So if I put indirect ERCA instead of modified ERCA, the whole curve moves this way, but not very far.
And this is also for a very big amplitude.
Yeah, that is true, and I did it for a. Yeah, because I did this model because it was sort of the most self-consistent one for free fermions without interactions and so on. Putting in a 10-kilometer radius raised this by a factor of, I think it was about 2. Okay.
Did you just want to take a few minute break before we go again? So let's come back in about 5 minutes and then we'll have to do that.
But this is a classical rain of pulsar with a strong magnetic field problem. So I know that there were a few cases which were a little older than where the Cooley curve drops strongly and which had some temperature which is non-zero. For those cases, if the magnetic field is strong, so if the spin down is fast, then this is really not relevant because
everyone knows.
But you need the spin down because of the note to change the configuration.
The parameter which is relevant for this is the spin down luminosity, the omega times omega dot. And so that is largest in the very youngest pulsars and in the millisecond pulsars. Because in the youngest omega dot is taken for the millisecond pulsar and the omega tree. And for the young pulsars, it's not very significant because they have internal heat, so you wouldn't notice the difference. And the stuff goes very quickly to equilibrium. But it is significant for the millisecond pulsars. So it's typically 10 to the 8 years old or something like that. That's for both, it is interesting. And for those, I compared it with those which were available at the time. I have repeated it since then. And there were actually no safe detections of thermal stains in the second pulsars. At least at that point, I haven't looked at this again. And they were.
Years ago.
The limits were still higher than what this was predicted in terms of the luminosity. Except possibly in the supercooled case, and there were, I tried to start suggesting a little bit that the gap, but there wasn't very much.
I left a room for a minute during the question period, and when I came back, you were talking about unmodified ERCA.
Yeah.
What it would do, and so I missed the source of the unmodification, so to speak. Magnetic field, or anything to say?
Basically, what people talk about is that a different equation of state may produce a higher electron price, and in that way allow for momentum conservation.
Either different or something. Yeah. So you weren't looking at the positive or unmodified.
No. In fact, I mentioned it only as a possibility for one thing. How likely the reactor rate might change. Because there was a question about what
the very different talk, by the way.
Thank you.
On that thermally dynamic stuff, I want to look carefully at your transparency.
Okay.
As I hope to.
Excuse me?
I hope to, I said.
Okay. I will be here for the rest of this week, but not more than that.
You're not coming back?
And I will come back for the conference in October, but then I will be here only for 3 days or so.